I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. This week, we're taking a look at Doug Jones' victory over Roy Moore in Alabama, in which black women reminded us all that they're evangelicals too.
We'll also discuss what it says about the state of our abortion politics when so many pro-life voters felt they had no choice but to vote for an accused child molester and an all-around unfit individual.
And we'll ask whether never-Trump conservatives, especially evangelicals, have learned their lesson, or if they're still contributing to the broken politics that brought about our current moment.
So we are recording this episode on Tuesday night, about an hour after the Alabama Senate race was called for Doug Jones. Roy Moore is naturally refusing to concede and says he's, quote, waiting on God.
It has been quite a day. It started with yet another Donald Trump hate tweet, punching back at Kirsten Gillibrand after she called for him to resign over sexual assault allegations from more than a dozen women now, with Moore speaking up just this week. I love that her staff had to call her out of the bipartisan Bible study she attends every Tuesday morning.
It was amazing.
She was in there with other senators in order for them to tell her about this tweet so she could respond.
That's incredible. And before we even got the results in the Alabama race, Jake Tapper from CNN had to school one of Roy Moore's surrogates, who was under the firm impression that every politician in America is required to swear an oath of office on the Christian Bible, which raises, it was like something straight out of The Office. It was so awkward. I watched it so many times, and every single time my reaction was exactly the same, of my mouth open, just like covering my eyes and yet laughing so hard. It was incredible to watch. But the whole thing raised the question of what exactly are they teaching in Alabama about the law? It's been such a day. And I said on social media earlier this week that I was really going to try to cut back on my swearing. And
I missed that one.
I did. You know, I really felt like, it's just, number one, I have little kids. And so I just need to watch my mouth more around my children.
Fair.
Because they're just these little parrots, right? They just kind of repeat back what you say. But number two, I was like, I should probably hold off the really intense language for really intense moments. And can I just say that this is one of those really intense moments? Like, holy shit. I cannot believe that Doug Jones won. I can't believe it. I have to go on record and say I thought for sure Roy Moore was going to win. I really did. I have never been so happy to be very wrong. I'm so happy that I was wrong. And I'm sad to say that I really didn't have a lot of hope for this particular election. I thought for sure we hadn't hit bottom, because it seems like every day there was something new and terrible that we had to, wrestle with and deal with.
Sure. But wait, here's the thing. You were right and wrong, because looking at the exit polls and how white evangelicals behaved, and, they are the vast majority of Alabama voters. And so I think it was not unreasonable to assume that how they voted was how the race was going to go. They did still back Roy Moore at extremely high numbers. It's that 81% again that keeps haunting us.
Ugh. I think it was Nate Pyle on Twitter that said the 81% is the new 666. Which is super funny. But you're right. There is, and frankly, there really was, don't get me wrong, I'm super happy to be wrong, and I'm super happy that the race turned out the way that it did and that Alabama did not elect Roy Moore. But in my defense, I feel like I had good reason to believe that this just was not in the bag. Like, we can't assume, particularly that white evangelicals are not going to do the right thing, but also that there's a bottom to this whole horrible situation that we have found ourselves in as a country. Because it truly does seem like every single day we wake up to something new where the bottom drops out from underneath us. And we're like, oh, we still haven't hit bottom yet. And for so many people, especially women that I have talked to, Roy Moore getting elected would have been like hitting bottom for them. And so it feels like such a relief. I don't know how you feel, but it is like when I saw that they finally called the race for Doug Jones, I was like, I actually cried. Like I shed real tears because I think it felt like such a relief to me. I don't know how you felt about it, but that is, whew, this was like a roller coaster of emotion dealing with this.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it changes politics in the Senate.
Right.
Anything less than the majority still means that I think McConnell's going to push through everything they were always going to try to push through. This just, means you have to appeal to the conscience of one fewer Republican senator. Maybe with the retiring Corker and Flake, this makes a few things easier. But in general, I agree with you that it was a interesting and pleasant surprise of a result. But I kind of immediately just got angry again at the fact that it was even this close.
And right.
Angry in a few different directions.
Yes.
Somebody has already pulled out this result, and I'm sure by the time our podcast comes out, people will have really sifted through every single one of the exit poll numbers. But this one I found particularly interesting, which was the difference between how women with kids voted and women without kids. So Moore lost women without kids overall by 11 points. He lost mothers by 34 points. And I don't think that's a surprise. What is discouraging is that there was essentially no difference at all between men with children and men without children in terms of their support for Moore. So there is a limit still to what men can do to women and have people get upset about. I do think this is a moment that women are going through, and it remains to be seen whether it is a just temporary moment or whether this is a movement. Those are two very different things in terms of their power and their ability to bring about lasting change. Just one of the things that made me so sad today, right after I was cringing / laughing at the Jake Tapper video with the Roy Moore dude.
it was so
I saw
bad.
A couple of other clips from cable news. They were interviewing Trump voters all over the place, of course, because that's everybody's favorite trend still. But there were a couple of clips of pastors down in Alabama saying basically, no, yeah, I don't think that Roy Moore would be a good senator, and I don't want him to support us. And this was the quote, though, that each of them had, but what other choice do I have?
Right. And, oh, my gosh. And
that just kind of hit me in the gut.
Yeah, because we've talked about this, how it all hinges on abortion, right? Like that's what they're saying is like, what other choice do I have? Because
yep.
Doug Jones is pro-choice.
Not pro-choice. Not pro-choice-ish. According to Robert Jeffress, who was on TV on Fox this morning, and this is what really gets me. Every description of Doug Jones was pro-abortion.
Right.
And this morning with Jeffress and basically everything that I have heard out of evangelicals who have been pushing the vote for Moore was basically guilt-tripping pro-life voters into believing that they would have the blood of babies on their hands if they voted for Doug Jones, who is pro-choice, but hardly an extremist when it comes to abortion. And yet Robert Jeffress was on TV saying, you know, Doug Jones doesn't care if a woman's 30 weeks pregnant and then just decides she doesn't want a baby, which, by the way, doesn't happen. And even if it did, Doug Jones does not support what would be an illegal abortion at that point.
Right. It's illegal in the state of Alabama. You can't get an abortion after 22 weeks. Is that correct? I think it's 22 weeks.
I believe, but basically there's nowhere in the country where you can just decide.
Right. At like 30 weeks.
That you are tired of being pregnant.
Right.
What doctors would do is have an early delivery if there was a health reason that you could not continue carrying the baby.
Exactly right. Like that, like, I mean, they call that like a quote unquote, like partial birth abortion, which there's a federal ban on. Like there's still some like restrictions around late term abortions. And
oh, absolutely.
Just like any abortion after 22 weeks in Alabama is illegal unless the life of the mother is in jeopardy in that moment. I think that's the only exception. So even though Doug Jones himself may be, you know, pro-choice, like there are still like he can't single-handedly upend the laws in the state of Alabama. Like that's not how this works, which goes back to our original point that we talked about a few weeks ago when we said like so much of this rhetoric and so much of our conversation about abortion is being hijacked. So much of the rhetoric is being hijacked, and we're actually not talking about reducing the number of abortions, but more like these sort of flashpoints in individual, you know, these kind of like individual ideologies in our candidates rather than what do their policies actually do for the abortion rate. And it makes me so irate. And this is one of those instances where it's even more exacerbated because the alternative was a guy accused of child molestation. Like, I just, whoa! Yeah. It's horrible that it's gotten to this point, that the rhetoric matters more than policy on pretty much every issue, but specifically on abortion, to the point where people would consider voting for a guy like Roy Moore over a guy like Doug Jones, who does support overall policies that actually do reduce the abortion rate. It just is really, really frustrating.
Yeah, I guess what gets me are two different things in this. One is that the idea of calling somebody pro-abortion is not just a matter of semantics. It really is not just, oh, well, you know, that's what happens in politics and campaigns and people, you know, hurl different labels at each other to try to hurt them. It has worked its way into the way that some pro-life voters think, which is to say, I saw a few comments throughout social media in the past couple of weeks by people who were sympathetic to Jones and, in fact, in some cases were defending him. I saw one woman say, you know, I'm pro-life, but I think that Doug Jones is right, that women should be able to decide for themselves in these cases, because I've heard, you know, some of these sad stories about couples who have a pregnancy that's really wanted and there's a fetal abnormality that's incompatible with life. And, you know, we've all read about these examples. And I every time want to say that is pro-choice. That is pro-choice. That is what you are saying. And if that is what so many pro-life voters are thinking pro-life means, I'm unable to speak on this because it makes me so frustrated that what do they think pro-abortion means? Like, what is this idea that people have gotten through their heads? And the other thing that just gets me is, and, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm very happy that Roy Moore is not going to be the next senator for Alabama, but I think there is a lesson that is going to go unlearned from Democrats here, which is whatever your messaging and reputation on the abortion issue is in Alabama. It is so bad that this many good pro-life people thought that they had to side with Roy Moore against a Democrat, against any Democrat, because they are so worried about what voting for a Democrat means for abortion. And I know this gets the hackles up of so many of my friends and colleagues who say, you know, we should not have to go after those voters. We don't want to support abortion restrictions. We don't want to have to, you know, throw women under the bus. To which I always say, it's not a matter of throwing women under the bus. You're already doing things, as you just outlined, Nish, to lower the abortion rate. It's plummeting thanks to Obama era policies. And all you have to do is be willing to take credit for it. And we have just not seen a Democrat nationally or in one of these close races be willing to take credit for that.
That's exactly right. And actually framing, like, they don't have to throw women under the bus, like you were saying. They don't have to all of a sudden go be anti-abortion in order to get some disaffected evangelical voters into the Democratic voting bloc. The only thing they have to do is very clearly and very in a very compelling way start articulating some of the core Democratic policies, like access to free and affordable health care, including birth control and family leave and a, you know, supported living wage, and like all of these sorts of things that are inherently doing hard work in lowering the abortion rate. The only thing they have to do is, in a compelling way, figure out how to package that policy result and say, this is inherently pro-life. These policies are inherently pro-life because we have the hard data that shows you that these policies lower the abortion rate. I don't know if it's just me or what, but I just don't feel like that's that hard. And yet,
oh no, it's not.
It's really not that hard. And I look at the Democratic Party and go, you are missing out. You're missing out on this huge swath of potential voters who are really disaffected right now with Trump and with Roy Moore and with all of the other people down the line that will eventually be up for re-election. Like, there's a really great opportunity here to build a broader coalition among Democrats. Now, if there's something also that Alabama teaches us, is that they don't necessarily have to bend on abortion in order to win.
Right.
But if Democrats really do care about making this a party for everyone, where everyone is welcome, and we are the party of, you know, welcome and hospitality and equal rights for everybody and all of those sorts of things, then it has to be a little bit more big tent. And that's the question they're just going to have to ask, is just how big tent do we want to be? And I can't answer that for them. I'm not a Democratic Party operative, but it seems to me like there's a great opportunity here that they could take advantage of, especially in some swing states. And I just don't see them doing it, which is really kind of a bummer. So,
well, and it need not come at the expense of spending more time and attention on people of color, because it was Black women who delivered this election for Doug Jones.
Black women have come in time and time again and have worked to save the Republic.
They absolutely have. And I want to give them the credit here, but I also saw some folks on Twitter immediately pushing back and saying, you know, this shows Democrats that they need to stop going after voters they can't get and just focus on delivering for Black voters. And
right, I don't think it's a
both
zero sum.
And yeah, they absolutely need to start paying more attention than just the month before an election when they show up to Black churches. They need to be in the Black community all the time and listening and delivering. And guess what? A lot of Black voters are also pro-life.
That's exactly right.
So they might feel a little better about their votes for Democratic candidates if Democrats could also just find the backbone to accept that a lot of voters think it's a good thing to lower the abortion rate. And they would like to know that Democrats believe that too. You know, I'll tell you what the sticking point is for Democrats, and it is going to just drive you up a wall like it drives me, because it's unbelievable that this is what makes the difference. But it's that what the choice groups tell Democratic politicians is, if you talk too much about abortion reduction, you are implying that to get an abortion is a bad thing, and that will stigmatize it and make women who get abortions feel bad. And I will grant you that we don't want to make women feel worse about their choices in their lives than we already do. But the expense that this comes at is just unbelievable to me, that they are willing to hold this line, even knowing that it's going to lead to lost elections, and therefore people who are going to put in place policies that will result in harm to women. It's a no-brainer to me, but I've been fighting this fight for 15 years now, and I do not know how to get through to Democrats.
And I mean, that divide is ultimately just going to be, I'm afraid, made deeper when you look at, you know, the polling out of Alabama, and, you know, how 80% of people who voted for Moore believed that abortion should be illegal in all cases. 64% said illegal in most cases. And for Jones, legal in all cases was 86%, and legal in most cases was 77%. So, like, the gap is just so wide. But again, I think so much of it is built on this false rhetoric and this puffed up rhetoric that has framed the debate in such a way that is going to create this divide where the left is going to become even more further left and alienate themselves from the right, and the right is going to do the same.
Well, and where the question is legality.
Right.
Not results.
That's exactly right. And this has always been my biggest beef with Republicans, specifically hardcore pro-life Republicans, is so many people get hung up on the legality and the court and the justices, right? But they're putting all their eggs in that basket with no guarantee. Like, there's no guarantee that with a majority court, which, by the way, we have right now for the most part in the Supreme Court, with a majority conservative court, that you're going to get in a Roe overturn, right? That Roe will be overturned. There's no guarantee with any justice appointment that you will get Roe overturned. And yet in the meantime, you're willing to completely ignore the data. You're willing to completely ignore the hard facts that say there are actual things you can do right now on the ground that will reduce the number of abortions in this country. And because of the rhetoric and because of the personal view of the candidate, you're willing to let all of that go for the sake of the possibility of another justice. Like, that shows me that you actually don't care about lowering the abortion rate. What you care about is the politics of abortion. And those are two very different things. And I am a pro-life Democrat. I know a lot of people would say there is no such thing, but sorry, I am one. And so I am a pro-life Democrat. And for me, I don't put my eggs, I don't put any sort of weight on the court. I don't think that's the best way to go about it, because I don't think it's a holistic option. I really firmly believe the best thing we can do is start lowering the abortion rate in ways that's holistic for all people, in ways that serves all populations, specifically women in all different realms of their health, and start doing that now. Like, why would we wait? Why would you wait? If it's this important, if the rhetoric is this heated, and if you're willing to vote for a guy like Roy Moore on something as important to you as abortion, if it's that important to you, why wouldn't you vote for policies that will actually lower the abortion rate? It makes no sense to me, Amy. It makes no sense to me. And this is where the, I don't want to call it hypocrisy, but cognitive dissonance is so loud on the Republican side to me on the issue of abortion, is we're going to put it all in the court and we're going to do nothing to lower the abortion rate right now. When in reality, you actually could if you were willing to meet in the middle. But no one's willing to meet in the middle on this. And the numbers are showing that that divide is getting worse and worse, which, like you said, I don't really know how to fix it, but here we are talking about it. So maybe it'll change one person's mind. We don't know. But
well, and this is where I want to call out the Never Trumpers, which we mentioned at the top here, because in the past year, really, but especially over the past few months, we've seen some kind of intellectual leaders on the right who have never been pro-Trump. But who are also starting to finally realize that, maybe the entire religious right movement is rotten at the core. And I don't know how you feel about this, but it kind of drives me up a wall to see Michael Gerson and Ross Douthat and just this morning, David French in the National Review.
Oh, David French. Like, please.
Finally having the wool pulled out from over their eyes. Because I want to say, like, this has been going on for decades.
Decades.
Like, where have you been? This is not an invention of the Trump era. This was the logical consequence of what you supported all the way along. And what just makes me still just fiery angry about it is that they continue, even in each of these columns where they're bemoaning the direction in which the religious right has taken the country. It's like they cannot help themselves. I can't tell whether it's just like a reflex they can't control, or they feel that they need to throw in some of these qualifiers just to maintain their cred, but they just continue to harp on the same stuff that makes this political issue so, so hard. Every single one of them will throw out, you know, the pro-abortion Doug Jones, or, well, of course, you know, if Democrats weren't so pro-abortion, along with any number of other issues, including, of course, just continuing to beat Hillary Clinton to a pulp.
Oh, and if the Democrats weren't so hung up on, you know, identity politics and yada yada. Oh, barf, spare me.
And I just want them to take both some responsibility for having gotten us to this point, but also recognize that there is no turning it around so long as you continue to fearmonger, and especially on the issue of abortion.
This is the thing. Don't get me wrong. I am glad that some of these guys are final, like that they have a line in the sand where they won't cross it, right? Like, Trump is a place where they're like, I can't go there, right? But the lack of self-awareness, the lack of self-reflection is really annoying, because, like you said, so much of what they've done, and so, like, this is a road that has been paved for years, that Trump is really the natural conclusion to where the Republican Party has been headed for years. And these guys and their unwillingness to reconcile with their own role in that bullshit is super annoying, and it's really gross. And it makes me look at their, you know, quote unquote, Never Trump position and go, do you really take issue with it? Because a lot of what we're seeing now is the natural result of all of the bricks that you've been laying over all these different years. And so it's super obnoxious to me at this point.
Yeah. There's a phrase a couple of them have used that, you know, they're appalled and embarrassed that the Republican Party and the religious right have become, you know, a caricature of what liberals always accuse them of being. And I want to say, oh, so maybe it wasn't a caricature.
Right, because there was actually some truth.
Maybe it was that we were calling out what was going on. And you are not the first to, you know, figure out that there's something rotten and corrupt here. We've been saying it all along.
For years.
And it's like, oh, well, you know, I am now noticing this.
Therefore, there is now a problem.
I have to say this with sorrow. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Makes me want to slap them all. But I do think that it is worth going back and like talking a little bit about these exit polls, specifically along race and looking at the breakdown of both gender and gender by race. 72% of white men voted for Roy Moore. 63% of white women voted for Roy Moore, which I'm going to get to that here in just a minute. 93% of black men voted for Doug Jones. 98% of black women voted for Doug Jones. And it goes without saying that the resistance to Trumpism, to Roy Moore and to everything that the Republican Party now stands for, the resistance has been led without question by black women. And it is, I said this before the election of Donald Trump, that if we actually listened to women of color and actually followed their lead, we would not be in this disaster. And this is something that I am feeling more and more and more passionate about, is calling out the really problematic views and the problematic voting patterns of white women in this country. And the statistics that we're seeing in the Alabama election, that 63% of white women voted for Moore, just goes to show again that we have some cleaning house to do, and that there are some things that we need to talk about as white women, and in what are the areas for specifically for white women in some of these places who are voting for Trump, who are voting for Moore, in what are the areas of policy that we need to start working in our own camp to start moving the needle, and in what ways can we start calling out some of the inherent racism and really, in some cases, almost internalized misogyny. In what ways can we start calling out some of these really problematic patterns that we're seeing in white women that is leading our country into a really destructive place? And I don't know what you have to think about it, but I know for me, I'm feeling more and more and more compelled to start calling out particularly other white women and saying, it is time to get our house in order. And I've been saying it for a long time, but I think we need to start getting more women who feel similarly and who look at the work that black women have been doing, and particularly all these other women of color that have been doing for years and years and years, and say, we need to start following their lead. We need to start listening to the issues that are important to them. We need to start working toward placing ourselves under their leadership and
raising up their voices, because often we have platforms that have not been available.
That's exactly right. And so that whole piece is twofold for me. In what way can we start calling out the problems within our own camp with white women, particularly white evangelical women? And then in what ways can we start following the leadership and elevating the issues that are important to Black women and elevating those voices? And yeah, I mean, this election just goes to show that the need to do that is even greater, because time and time again, Black women lead the way and they step in and try to like swoop in and save the Republic as much as they can. And they did it again tonight. And I'm just really, really thankful. I find myself very thankful time and time again for the way that they lead and the way that they come in and consistently do the right thing. And I don't know. I think it's just time for us white women to, as I like to say, it's time to circle up. We need to have a talk and figure this out, because the choices that we're making and the consequences of those choices are not okay. And so what can we be doing as more progressive women, more progressive white women, to start moving the needle on some of this stuff with more conservative white women? I don't know if you have any insight on that, but I know for me, it's feeling more and more passionate every single day that goes by since Trump's been elected. It's just like, oh, we have got to start moving the needle with white women.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, you and I have talked about this, that it is a problem of our making. And so it needs to be solved by us not putting the burden on women of color
to do the work. That's right.
Absolutely. And, you know, also for at least the near future, white women will continue to be a significantly larger piece of the voting population than Black women. So it cannot be all on them. It should not be all on them, and it cannot be all on them.
Yep.
So that's work that needs to be done. And those are conversations that we are starting, and, you know, with a motivation behind us doing this podcast, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Was, you know, starting to call out some of those issues. And I mean, I'm looking too at just the numbers here, and 98% of Black women voted for Doug Jones, but they were still only 17% of the total voters. 35% of the voters were white men, and 31% of the voters were white women. And I mean, underlying issues, like a lot of people will say, like, well, Black people just don't get out and vote, but there's a much bigger issue underneath that surface that we need to address, and that is voter suppression. And that's one of the biggest things that white women and white men too, but specifically white women, can use our platforms to, use our voices to, use our influence in our communities, and just the privilege that we have of being white women, is going in and working towards eliminating voter suppression, increasing voter turnout, making sure that our women of color neighbors and their families have the ability to vote. Everyone should have the ability to vote. And the fact that so many people don't is one of the greatest travesties of our democracy. And it's one of the biggest things that we can do to help Black women continue to lead and lead well, is by giving more of them the right and the ability to vote. And I know that's something that I'm going to be working toward, and that's something that I'm committing right now to figuring out, like, how can I start doing that more where I live in my community, figuring out, like, oh, what are the issues of voter suppression where I live, and what are the issues of gerrymandering, and what are the issues of, you know, all of these sorts of things that keep people of color from being able to vote and being able to make their voices truly heard in these districts and in these areas. And that's one of the big things that we can start doing.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that is one of these issues that should be a no-brainer for churches. If they want to get involved, it's not a matter of scarce resources. It is a matter of making sure that democracy is actually fully realized, that everybody has the access and the ability to vote.
Yeah, it's, and I mean, there are so many things that you can do. It's volunteering, whether that's, you know, I mean, actually offering your neighbors and being like, hey, can I drive people to polling places? Can I do it? Like, there's a whole slew of things that we can do. You can put pressure on legislators. You can put pressure on the federal government and our senators and our congresspeople to reinstate the Voting Rights Act. I mean, there are so many things that we can be doing as white women to make sure that women of color and their families and people of color in general can have access, because we're not a true democracy if not everyone has the access to vote. It's, you know, the most sacred duty that we have as Americans. And if not everyone has it, then it doesn't really mean as much in my mind. I want everyone to have it.
One place to get involved is Let America Vote, which is the organization that Jason Kander, the former Missouri Secretary of State, launched. And they are busy getting a presence in every part of the country, and have very specific ways that you can get involved, and things that you can do both for yourself to ensure that you have your rights, but more importantly, for your neighbors.
Yeah, there are a lot of good organizations out there that I know are doing work on voter suppression. And so we will mine some of the resources and make sure that we post links to those on our show notes when we're done, so that people have access to that, because that is a huge, huge issue, is making sure that everyone has the right. Because if we don't have the right, then we're headed into a even darker place. That's what I have to say about that.
Well, for now, it is getting late. So
I know it is late. It's like midnight here.
We are going to wrap up the show. And every week, we like to leave you with a recommendation or two, maybe a TV show, a movie, a podcast. Nish, tell me what you're loving this week.
Well, the first thing I'm loving is that Doug Jones is the new senator from Alabama.
What's something else you're loving?
Sorry, I couldn't help it. What am I loving? Okay, season 2 of The Crown on Netflix. Have you watched The Crown yet?
I have not watched any.
Amy.
I know.
I thought you loved England like I do.
I do, but I also, for whatever reason, I love dark.
Okay,
so
okay.
The third season of Broadchurch is next in my queue.
Gotcha. So The Crown is fantastic. It is about, it starts back with King George, the current Queen Elizabeth's father. And it starts with him, and it essentially is about Queen Elizabeth, the current queen, her rise to the throne. So the first season, we see her coronation. We see her kind of figuring out who she is as a monarch and, like, what does this mean? Because she was very young when she took over the throne. And so that's the whole first season. And then the second season, I'm like four or five episodes in. It really dives into her marriage with Philip and kind of the dynamics there, and him marrying, you know, this woman who now is the most powerful woman in England. And what does that mean for him? And I mean, it's just all these sorts of dynamics. It is obviously a drama. And the woman who, the actress who plays Queen Elizabeth, the young Queen Elizabeth, Claire Foy, is brilliant. Brilliant. And then there's also Matthew, I can't remember his name, who plays Prince Philip, for all of you Doctor Who fans. He was also in Doctor Who. Anyway, he is fantastic as Prince Philip. John Lithgow in season 1 plays Winston Churchill, which I was kind of surprised by. I'm like, oh, how is that going to go? But he was brilliant as Winston Churchill. So it kind of like walks you through just a dramatic retelling of the current Queen Elizabeth, of her ascension to the throne. And season 2 has started, and I'm so happy because, as we know, for whatever reason, I love all things royal. I can't quit the royal family, and it's just a really brilliantly done show. So I'm really, really happy. I'm happy that it's back. So I'm happy to be watching that right before Christmas. Feels, you know, something to like cozy into at the end of the day. What about you? What are you watching?
Well, you know, another way you can watch Royals is to go see The Last Jedi. in which Harry and Will have walk-ons, I think, as stormtroopers.
They do, and they walked the red carpet last night. I saw that.
It was so sweet.
So awesome. Yes. I cannot wait to see it. It is my daughter's favorite thing, and so...
Right. We both have children who are obsessed.
Obsessed with Star Wars. So,
except the difference between us is... Your daughter loves watching this stuff too.
Oh gosh, we have watched the entire saga. I don't even up to this point, like all seven. Well, if you count Rogue, all eight.
Oh wow, she even eight saw movies. Rogue One.
Oh yeah, we've watched them all, and we've watched them all. I can't even tell you how many times we watched it tonight. We watched A New Hope tonight before bedtime.
Oh, it's that just makes me jealous.
It's overkill. Let's be honest.
Well. No, because our child is, she gets scared by anything that is, you know, more dramatic and tense than Charlie Brown.
Oh.
Which is still, to date, the only movie we have seen in the in the theater. So
hey, the Peanuts movie was great.
It was wonderful, yes. And she saw it three times in the theater.
Well, my daughter has a birthday coming up, December 28th, and... It is the only thing she has asked for. She doesn't want a party. She wants to go to the movie theater with her little best buddy, Oliver, to go see the new Star Wars movie. And then we're going to come back here and eat Star Wars cake and play Star Wars. That's like the only thing that she wants. So we are going to be in full Star Wars mode here in just a couple of weeks. So I'm like trying to hold off just a little bit. But I do love Star Wars, but I know that I'm going to have to go full throttle with it here in a couple weeks. So I'm just going to absorb my British drama before I jump into Star Wars.
Well, I am all in for Star Wars. It can't be the thing I love yet because it hasn't come out yet. But I will be seeing it this weekend, and then I will be retelling every single part of the plot to our daughter because that's how she heard about The Force Awakens. And she will be expecting a detailed plot summary of The Last Jedi. And then she and her little brother, who really has no idea what's going on in Star Wars, but if his big sister loves it, he loves it. So they will be running around pretending to be all of the characters. And I kind of love that. In fact, last year for Christmas, I gifted her my original Star Wars action figures from the 1980s.
That's amazing.
Yes, which my parents had held on to and which are in pristine condition because, of course, even though we played with them all the time, my sister and I were very good with our toys. Have they already gotten broken?
Of course they have. Because your kids are less careful than you were. That's amazing. What a cool gift to be able to pass that down. That's fun.
I think so. It even had the official carrying case with the scene of the Death Star on the outside.
Wow.
It was just an awesome little time capsule from the 1980s.
That's amazing. That's incredible. Well, anything else? Or is you're just in Star Wars mode? Just ready?
We're just waiting. Just, yeah, deciding whether or not to bring the lightsaber with me.
Decisions.
Never know. Might need something to read by.
That's true. All right. Well, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please subscribe and visit us on Facebook at Impolite Company, the podcast, and leave a review for us on iTunes. We would love to hear from you and get your feedback, and we will post links to our show notes on our website as well. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.